I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up on today's show, we revisit three conversations that are relevant to Donald Trump's victory on Tuesday. We'll hear from author Thomas Frank, whose most recent book, Listen Liberal, is about the Democratic Party and how they have let the working class down. We'll also hear my discussion with historian and author Nancy Eisenberg. Her book, White Trash, traces the origins of that pejorative term. But first, we'll explore the mindset and lives of the people of Appalachia when we listen to my interview with J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. The results of this election have highlighted just how disenfranchised many voters feel, especially the white working class who voted for Donald Trump. On today's show, we're going to hear three conversations about the roots of this sentiment, and we begin with J.D. Vance. He grew up in the Appalachian regions of Ohio and Kentucky. He's the author of the widely cited book Hillbilly Elegy, which explains the concerns and mindset of the Rust Belt, the same that Trump was so effective in appealing to throughout his campaign. Vance joined me earlier this year to discuss his life, his book, and coal country. Let's listen. You write about something that you call Appalachian values. On the one hand, it served families like yours, and on the other hand, it created problems. Describe what you mean.
Yeah, well, so it was a pretty rough and tumble world in a lot of ways. So one of the things you really learned to value was your family's sense of honor, your family loyalty, and your sense that you really owed something to your family, both financially and culturally. And like I said, these traits are good and they're important, but at the same time, they create certain pressures. They create pressures sometimes to violence that obviously isn't super productive if you're trying to live a successful life. They create pressures to not leaving, not going and getting an education, not going and finding a better life for yourself. That also can be, good because it keeps you humble, but it can be bad, right? Because it can create certain self-destructive tendencies to not get out when what, at the end of the day, you need to do is go and find education and employment elsewhere.
And when you look at some of the communities that have been hollowed out and you see those jobs are no longer there, are the problems because of the fact that factories have moved away or shut down? Or is it something about culture or something about a combination of the two?
I really think it's the combination of the two. I mean, one of the things that I try to emphasize in the book is that even though I'm writing primarily about the cultural and some of the non-economic pressures, I think it's very important to recognize that the economic pressures were there and were very important. At the end of the day, we often have what I think of as a very ideological conversation about whether this is culture or whether this is economics. But I think that what's going on is that both is happening and they're obviously interconnected. Culture affects economics and vice versa. I mean, just to give a very concrete example, it's very hard to have a successful family, have a successful marriage if you're under economic duress, but it's also very hard to keep a job and to be a good worker if your family isn't stable like mine wasn't. So it's a pretty complicated and intertangled problem, but hopefully I gave at least some reason to think that complexity could be unpacked a little bit.
Let me read a couple of sentences from your book, and this is your memoir. You write, "We choose not to work when we should be looking for jobs. Sometimes we'll get a job, but it won't last. We'll get fired for tardiness or for stealing merchandise and selling it on eBay or for having a customer complain about the smell of alcohol on our breath or for taking 5 30-minute restroom breaks per shift. We'll talk about the value of hard work, but tell ourselves that the reason we're not working is some perceived unfairness. Obama shut down the coal mines or all the jobs went to China. These are the lies we tell ourselves to solve the cognitive dissonance, the broken connection between the world we see and the values we preach." I underlined that. I circled it. I scored it. I just think that's such an important paragraph.
The point there is that I should say that, that's not necessarily true of most people in the community, right? So a lot of people are working hard, are trying to get ahead. and they just, you know, they've been hit hard by life circumstances, and I don't think we should discount that. But there is a significant minority of people who, you know, they aren't doing the things that they need to do to get ahead. And instead of sort of recognizing that problem, recognizing that it exists, they are perfectly willing, or maybe they just have to tell themselves stories about why they're unable to work, or why they're not working, or why they're not contributing more meaningfully to their families. And, you know, that's something that I think we have to fess up to as a culture and as a community, to recognize that there are both the really hardworking folks who are trying to get ahead but can't, but that there are also people in our community who are not being totally fair to themselves and are not maybe recognizing quite the role that their own agency is playing in some of their circumstances.
I mean, that's a hard thing to try to deal with. What do you suggest?
I don't think that we can go through, I think our politics suffers from this problem. I think that our personal lives suffer from this problem. But I don't think that we can go through life without at least admitting that there's a significant disconnect between some of the values that we preach and some of the actions that we take. And it's not just in work, you know, it's in family. We are, you know, traditionally associated with social conservatism. I think importantly, we talk about the importance of family and marriage, but we have skyrocketing divorce rates. You know, we talk about the importance of sort of doing well and living a good life, but we have much higher crime rates than we used to. So I think that the very first thing that we have to do as a community is sort of look ourselves in the mirror and say, look, some of these things, some of the values that we preach aren't necessarily practiced in our broader community.
How do you understand the appeal of Donald Trump to the white people that we have been talking about? Is it his platform? Is it his language? Is it his biography? What do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think there are both. There are two basic appeals to Donald Trump. One is relatively illegitimate, and the other is legitimate. So the illegitimate one is I think that what Trump offers is a very simple solution to a series of complex problems that the community has experienced. So from drug addiction to family breakdown to rising joblessness and so forth, Trump basically says, look, here are some, you know, we're going to change our trade partnerships with China. We're going to build a wall along the Mexican border, and we're going to bring the jobs back. And I think that that's illegitimate, because at the end of the day, I think very few people think that Trump will actually help things. The more legitimate part of Trump is that he is at least identifying pretty significant problems that exist in the community, and he's making the community feel seen and feel heard in a way that it hasn't been by the political elites in at least two or three decades. And so, you know, if you think about a lot of these blue-collar white Americans are increasingly feeling that the political elites look down on them, that they condescend to them, that they don't really care about the very significant set of social and economic problems that exist in their communities, then what I think you'll recognize is that they've been looking for a long time for someone who will break through the fog, who will say, look, I see your problems, I hear you, and I'm going to build a platform around your particular set of concerns. That's what Trump has really done. If you think about the past 20 or 30 years of Republican politicians, you know, John McCain ran on the same platform as George W. Bush, and Mitt Romney ran on the same platform as John McCain. Trump is really the first person who has recognized that the Republican base is primarily the white working class, and he's really gone after them. And that's something pretty powerful when you felt ignored for a long time.
What, though, has the Republican Party done for poor and working class whites in this country?
Well, if you know, my view, and I say this as a Republican, is that the Republican Party actually hasn't done a whole lot in terms of substantive politics. But what the Republican Party has done, at least, is make itself culturally felt in these areas. You know, if you look at a map of sort of the parts of the country that are red versus blue, the parts of the country that are blue are almost exclusively along the coast and in large cities in the middle part of the country. Whereas the Republican Party is effectively the dominant enterprise, political enterprise everywhere else. And so there's something to be said for, you know, the feeling that there are fundamentally two Americas right now. There are the coastal elites, and there's middle America. And a lot of folks, I feel, and not totally wrongly, that the coastal elites are on one side of a division and middle America is on another side of a division. And the Republican Party, for all of its faults, and I think Donald Trump is the product of a lot of those faults, the feeling that the Republican Party doesn't represent people and so forth, they are still Republicans because they, you know, the Republicans live in their areas and go after their votes. And again, are not quite as culturally disconnected.
Even though Donald Trump said during one of the primary debates he didn't believe in a minimum wage, there's certainly a numbers of stories about him ripping off people that worked for him that he decided he wasn't going to pay. I'm just curious about how that plays among people who are trying to work hard for a living and trying to better their lives.
Well, I don't think it plays especially well in the details, but it has to be set against a backdrop of a very long campaign, and not just a long campaign, but a sort of long cultural transition in American politics. I mean, I think that the most underappreciated part of Donald Trump, for those who, you know, reasonably want to talk about the substantive policies or the actual pronouncements of the candidates, is that they have to recognize that people who are voting for Donald Trump, you know, whether you want to call it rural culture or Southern culture or whatever, they feel that the Democratic Party is fundamentally disconnected, that they, you know, look down on people like them, that they condescend to their set of values. And Trump, for all of his faults, has actually gone after these voters in a very targeted way. It's kind of hard to imagine someone voting for Donald Trump when you think about all the things that he said, right, until you recognize that on the other side is Hillary Clinton. And for a lot of people, Hillary Clinton represents the other side of a very significant divide.
Let me quote something else from your book. You write, Barack Obama strikes at the heart of our deepest insecurities. He's a good father, while many of us aren't. He wears suits to his job, while we wear overalls, if we're lucky enough to have a job at all. His wife tells us that we shouldn't be feeding our children certain foods, and we hate her for it, not because we think she's wrong, but because we know she's right. J.D. Vance, expand on that.
Yeah, well, it's really about, you know, I think that there's a conversation about what underlies a lot of the resistance to President Obama. And, you know, I certainly think that race and sort of racial anxiety is part of it. But I think there's something else that's much less appreciated, which is that Barack Obama is sort of the embodiment of what it takes to get ahead in the United States of America in a time when a lot of working class white Americans feel that they are the opposite of what it takes to get ahead in the United States of America. So, you know, Barack Obama, he's obviously very intelligent. He speaks extremely well. He has elite credentials from universities that seem somewhat foreclosed to a lot of lower class white folks. And if you think about that and you contrast him to, you know, where a lot of working class white Americans are living their lives, you know, they're not going to college. They're certainly not going to Harvard Law School. They don't really feel that the modern American meritocracy was built for them. And in some cases, they're right. And I think that Barack Obama came out on the scene right as a lot of people were starting to lose faith in the American dream. I mean, they see the American dream as this thing that was always, you know, open to them. And right at the moment where they feel something was being closed off to them, here's this president who is very, very good at you know, the American meritocratic game. And I think that's a really striking juxtaposition. And I think it explains a lot of the insecurity and the anger that underlies resentment towards the president.
That was my interview with J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, recorded earlier this year. When we get back from the break, we'll continue our look at some of the causes of the rise of Donald Trump when we hear from historian and author Nancy Eisenberg. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Donald Trump's campaign and subsequent victory has given a voice to the underserved and often demeaned white population who have long felt left behind by the political establishment. They've been called many things: low class, middle America, and most harshly, white trash. Author and historian Nancy Eisenberg's recent book, White Trash, A 400-Year History of Class in America, traces this term and the people it's been used to describe. She joined us earlier this year to tell us about the history of class divisions in America. Let's listen. Well, let's go back 400 years to when colonists were coming to this country. And as you write, poor people, it seemed, that maybe let out of prisons or let out of cities in a way, coming to the country, called expendable people or waste people. The idea that the colonists, I guess, with some money and perhaps some property, looked down on the people who were also brought to this country to do hard labor.
Right. We forget that North America, before it became the fabled city upon the hill, in the eyes of 16th century English promoters, adventurers, they saw it as a foul and weedy wilderness, a wasteland. And where they got that term from, and this is one of my other important things, is that class was connected to land. Because for half of our history, we were an agrarian nation. So the measure of success was the kind of land you lived on and whether you were even a property owner. For the English, the old world, they thought this was a perfect place to unload the idle poor. And who were they dumping in the new world? Convicts. And there was convict labor all the way up to the Revolution. Irish rebels, whores, ex-soldiers, people in debt, children of beggars, and basically the indentured servant, which is a class that we tend to forget about. But they were an exploited form of labor because essentially people signed away their lives from anywhere from 7 to 9 years. And you have to remember, when you're being sent to the New World in the 16th and 17th century, you're lucky if you're going to live that long. If you consider if you're like working in Virginia, working the fields with a hoe, it's physically demanding. There are numerous diseases. So most people who are being dumped into the New World aren't going to live long enough to even think about becoming property owners.
We're talking to you from Philadelphia, from Pennsylvania. You talk about Benjamin Franklin's obsession with idleness. Also talking about Quaker families in Pennsylvania, Penn being the most obvious example, and their view of poor people or poor white people.
Yeah, I have a whole section which begins with Franklin. And then I also talk about Tom Paine, who, as we know, arrived in Philadelphia at the time of the Revolution and wrote the very important treatise, Common Sense.
Right.
But both of them, I mean, Tom Paine, first of all, had only been in the United States for 13 months. He was an Englishman in exile. Franklin, we have to remember, Americans are British subjects. And Franklin's way of looking at the colonies, looking at the world, looking at poverty, came from an English perspective. So, yes, he sees idleness as not a sin because he's not a religious man, but he does see it as one of the flaws of Englishmen. And that's what's interesting, because at one point he claims that German immigrants work harder because somehow they didn't have handouts and support in Germany. So they had to work hard to survive. And that's kind of the dark side of Franklin's vision. Franklin was, despite the fact that he was a runaway servant, he had been an apprentice, he didn't come from an elite family, he really didn't have much sympathy for the poor as he acquired wealth and became such a famous man. And he promoted a theory that would be also adopted and promoted by Thomas Jefferson, the idea that what do you do with the poor? He felt that, workhouses or almshouses were not the best solution. What the solution would be the size of the American continent. That the way, and then here he's echoing exactly what the British were saying, that if you can't make it in the colonies on the coast, you need to move west. And he was also envisioning the frontier in two ways. One we can say is a dumping ground again. He referred to the poor in the frontier as refuse, again using
refuse.
That waste metaphor. He also argued that maybe the continent would be an advantage, that it would actually reduce class tension. Because of the size of the continent, people would move west, they'd spread apart, And that would produce what he referred to as a flattening out of the classes, what he called a happy mediocrity. Now, in theory, we could say, well, that's a nice idea, but of course it didn't play out that way because class and privilege moved west with the settlers.
Nancy, there are all sorts of pejoratives. I mean, white trash is a pejorative in and of itself. Is that like the N-word in your mind?
Well, I'll let you know, I write about a very important survey that was taken by the sociologist Howard Odum. And this was during the Great Depression, where he interviewed all his colleagues, academics, people who wrote about race and class around the country. And Ira Reed, who is an African-American scholar who lived in Atlanta, wrote him because the question he asked, he said, what does this word mean to you? What did it mean when you were growing up? And Ira Reed wrote back and said that when he was growing up, as a black man, a black child, he said you would never use the word white trash unless you expected to be called the N-word. So, yes, the word white trash, well into the 20th century, was very much seen to have the same negative, shameful notions that were associated with the racial slur. And I think we tend to forget about that. But one of the things that we have kind of two traditions in this country, one is to denigrate the poor, to emphasize that their destiny is set and that, as I said, nothing can do to actually raise them up. It's impossible to assimilate them into normal society. And that means that, you know, people above them don't have to care. They write them off, and you see that over and over again in American history. The other tradition is sort of the hillbilly vaudeville tradition, or the idea of the populist tradition, and that's where Jackson started when he began to represent not just the common man, but he was the man on the frontier, the cracker, that somehow the hardy experience of being on the frontier, making your own way. Davy Crockett, for example, was an advocate of squatter rights and a squatter. That somehow, that hardy, tough experience of the backwoodsman would somehow translate into making the American people stronger. But the problem with that whole myth is that once these civilization moves in, these people either have to be normalized, they have to become more sophisticated, more civilized, or what we find again, they need to move on. So, and the vaudeville tradition, this is, you know, also is loaded and heavy. We can connect it to Hee Haw, we can connect it to the Beverly Hillbillies, but there's always kind of a, you know, either a negative taint or you're laughing at the hillbilly rather than fully embracing the hillbilly.
And is it a view of a certain kind of Southerner? Is that how Americans tend to view so-called white trash?
And that's misleading, too. As I highlight, it's really a definition that comes from rural America. So in my book, I'm talking about why it's so important in the colonial period. I also talk about what when we look at the early republic and the antebellum period with squatters and crackers. We're talking about the Old Northwest. We're talking as well as the Southern backcountry. The reason it becomes associated with the South has more to do with politics. And I place a great deal of emphasis on the sectional controversy, the rise of Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party when they began to attack slavery as a labor system. One of the things that they emphasized not only was slavery denigrating to the slaves themselves, but it also undermined the ability of a poor white man to experience social mobility.
Well, let's take a giant leap into the 1930s during the Depression, thinking of those amazing photographs by Dorothea Lange, James Agee, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, and the kind of pictures of what it was to be poor, landless in many ways, homeless in many ways in America. And, of course, many of those photographs of poor whites.
Yeah, the 30s is a really interesting period. And what I argue is that because it's the moment in our history when 20% of the population are out of work by 1932, it suddenly means that you can't just dismiss the poor and say someone's lazy or someone's idle. And it's one of the more intellectually interesting periods mm-hmm. where not only photographers, but artists and intellectuals, academics, and a whole host of people begin to think about class in a much more sophisticated way. And you're right. I mean, one of the pictures that I have is important because, again, the 30s revived the idea of wasteland. Howard Odum, for example, discovered that the South had wasted so much land to erosion, the amount of land that was equivalent to both of the Carolinas and Georgia. And the image that for the period captured this idea of downward mobility, which is one of the dominant themes of the 30, was the gully, which is a very powerful, symbolic, metaphorical, and real material reference to the problems of the rural poor. And I talk a lot about the exploitation of poor white tenant farmers. And here's just a statistic for you that we need to remember about how consistently this population occupied the American imagination and American politics. At the time of the American Revolution in Virginia, 40% of the population of white men were landless, and they also didn't own slaves. By the 1930s, it's also 40%, and the majority of those people who are landless are living in the South. Two-thirds are in the South, and two-thirds are white. So part of the problem that we forget about is that agrarian societies do not promote social mobility. They're more static. At the time of the Revolution, for example, there was more social mobility in Great Britain than there was in the colonies, because what promotes mobility is a commercial society. So that legacy of having this rather large population of poor, landless people is why this idea of white trash and why it ends up being identified with the South. But I would say it's not purely in the South, because you also have similar terms for other rural areas outside of the South. For example, in New England, they were called swamp Yankees. You also can go to, when I talk about trailer trash, you also have poor rural areas in Wisconsin, Minnesota. So the idea of poor whites is really about the connection to rural society and the really negative connotations that we have about rural society.
I mean, Nancy, we struggle to talk about race in this country. Some conversations are more enlightening than others, but we don't talk a lot about class in this country. First of all, why do you think that is, and how do you think that creates a problem for us?
Well, I think that's where I highlight the importance of myth-making. Americans, as we know, often prefer the myth rather than the reality. It becomes part of the way we define ourselves as a people. And I begin the book by quoting Charles Murray, who presents that whole idea of an imaginary class-free America in his book Coming Apart. He basically said that a Gallup poll in 1963 was where Americans refused to say they were rich or poor. They said they were either middle class or working class. And he argued those refusals reflected a national conceit that has prevailed from the beginning of the nation. Americans didn't have classes, or to the extent that they did, Americans shouldn't act as if we did. Now, I wish that was true, but it really isn't true. And I think my book proves that throughout American history, what you do see, there are moments in political rhetoric when people want to diminish the importance of class, or they want to celebrate the idea of social mobility, or they want to imagine that we broke free from Great Britain and we left the class system behind. But there's also plenty of evidence, which I show, in which Americans are more than willing to talk about class and actually are very class conscious and very aware. And that's why we have all these names over the course of American history for denigrating poor whites, from offscourings to rubbish to rascals to refuse to bog trotters to rednecks to trailer trash. So I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that Americans were very aware of their class system. And just like the British, they wanted to police those boundaries between classes to ensure that there that the differences between the classes were well known, well marked, and well maintained.
Well, I'm also thinking about the lack of social mobility that we have today. I mean, I think there are a number of different reasons for that. I'm also thinking of Princeton University economist Angus Deaton, who got the Nobel Prize for economics last year. He and his wife, who's also an economist, Ann Case, did some amazing research finding that non-Hispanic whites ages 45 to 54 have a higher death rate based on things like overdoses and problems with drugs and alcohol, even suicide. What does that tell us then?
Yeah, I think, and that also ties into the older legacy, because in the antebellum period, white trash are called clay eaters and sandhillers. And they begin to be seen as clinical specimens. They are seen as, by that time, there's a great deal of emphasis on the yellow color of their skin, which is compared to tallow. Now, part of this is connected to the actual diseases they suffer from, which is hookworm and pellagra. But they also, again, that idea that we think of, or alcoholism is associated with them, but we think about the problem of the inequality of resources, and we tend to, because, you know, rural society can be put out of sight, we tend to not pay as much attention to it. And I think that's one of the problems. But their research, yes, I read their articles, and I think it's we have to be reminded of this. We have to remember that the American dream has never been available to all people. It's never been, you know, people don't start on an equal playing field. And that gets back to the idea of the importance of children. Sociologists have found today, in 2015, 2016, that the most important predictor for being successful in this country are the wealth and privileges not only passed from your parents, but passed down from your ancestors. So that idea of pedigree, that idea that, and I think this is the idea that would, for Americans, would be the hardest to accept, is how much privilege is reproduced from parent to child. We don't think of that. When we want to think of class, we say, well, it's wealth or it's income or you work hard to get ahead. But in fact, it really does matter where you begin as a child and the kinds of privileges you give. I also talk about the importance of class geography, where you live. We live in class segregated neighborhoods. And racially segregated neighborhoods. So that's also one of the barriers that I think we have to confront. We have to realize how much that is still with us.
That was my conversation with historian and author Nancy Eisenberg about her book White Trash, recorded earlier this year. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the Democratic Party and author Thomas Frank's take on their failures. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The election of Donald Trump has political watchers and historians trying to find an explanation for his appeal. Author Thomas Frank points his finger directly at the Democratic Party, blaming them for distancing themselves from the people they claim to support. His book, published earlier this year, is called Listen, Liberal. It details what he calls the failed policies and initiatives of the Democratic Party and their consequences. He spoke with Radio Times producer John Ahrens earlier this year about Democrats and his disappointment in them. Let's listen.
Well, I was thinking Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, you know, the Democrats of the post-war decades and the Great Depression, who always talked about the middle class and working people. And what's striking is how, although Democrats today often say, you know, similar things to those old-fashioned Democrats, the group that they really care about the most is very different.
And when did they move away from these ideals, or when did they stop being the party of the people?
What's fascinating is that you can actually trace that. They were very open about what they were doing, and they wrote about it and talked about it and theorized it and strategized it and did it. And it begins in the late 60s and early 70s with the Vietnam War and with all of the protests and anger over that. And the Democrats decided to reorganize their party and remove organized labor from its sort of structural role within the party and to sort of reach out and embrace a different group instead, and that group was white-collar professionals. What's fascinating, though, is that the Democrats stuck with it and developed all of these sort of complete theories of history to explain why this, you know, the white-collar professional class was going to be the, you know, the winners in history and why this was the group you had to embrace.
And do you see this move as a political one, or do you see it as them actually still trying to cater to working people in an idealistic way?
There's all sorts of idealism involved in this, but it's idealism of a different kind. It's not idealism of the sort of Labor Day variety, the salt of the earth, these are the people who built America. It's not that. It's idealism. President Obama gives you a perfect example of it. You look at his State of the Union speeches where he talks about innovation all the time. Or when these people talk about the creative class, they're extremely idealistic about this group of people. You know, when Hillary Clinton says that it's not like Goldman Sachs, they didn't bribe me, I can't be bought by, you know, people don't know me. She's absolutely right. It's not like this relationship of the Democrats and Wall Street isn't one where Wall Street is just buying them off. These people are in love. This is idealism.
But, I mean, the reality is from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, when they were sort of turning their back on sort of FDR politics, the reality is we did become a post-industrial country. To me, it seems like it would make sense to try to adapt to a new economy.
Sure, but you got to remember politics also makes the economy. So what you decide to adapt to is what, you know, what actually happens. Let's start with globalization.
Sure.
Okay, so because politicians and especially Democrats love to talk about globalization. And what they mean when they use that phrase is that globalization, this great overwhelming economic force that we can't even really begin to comprehend, is what came down to your industry and you know, your town and deindustrialized it, and what cost you your job. It was this majestic power of the entire globe. If you look at it, you know, NAFTA, for example, is 2,000 pages long. God didn't write that. Lobbyists wrote that. The Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is written by who the Democrats decided got a seat at the table. And those people wrote that treaty in their own interests and to ruin other classes of humans. And then they say, well, that's just globalization. You know, all that stuff that just happened to you, nothing we can do about it. It's just globalization.
Going back to Bill Clinton, you sort of point to him as a prime example of the shift away from democratic values. I mean, he's well known for having shifted to the center. And, you know, my father is one of these bring back Bill people. Why do you think that sentiment is still so popular?
Well, people don't remember what he actually did. They remember the last 3 years of his presidency, which were good times. Doing the research on Bill Clinton, I had to go back and read what he actually accomplished as president, and what his followers and admirers thought was great about his presidency. And there were five things that he did that they admired. I'm going to go down the list. First one was NAFTA. Then there was the crime bill of 1994. Then there was welfare reform. And there was deregulation of both banks and telecoms and a little bit of energy as well. And then the last thing was he balanced the budget. All of those except for the last one are unmitigated disasters. I mean, you think about NAFTA. This is deindustrialization all at once. This is it. The crime bill, this is what put a generation of black kids in mass incarceration. Welfare reform, this is strictly about disciplining people who work for a living, pulling out the floor from under them, making them desperate, and then deregulation of Wall Street. So while all these other things are going on, things like NAFTA, you know, and welfare reform that are designed to make workers much more insecure, at the same time, you're literally rolling back the rules for Wall Street. So yeah, there was a stock market bubble. There was a hell of a stock market bubble. But that's not a, you know, really good basis for prosperity. And we often remember him as, you know, as good times, because during that bubble, the economy was so heated up. And yes, wages did increase for 3 years in the Clinton administration, which was, hey, that was really, really good.
And unemployment was way down.
Unemployment was way down. It was, those last 3 years were good times. However, it was a bubble. I mean, we don't celebrate Calvin Coolidge as the greatest president, right? We don't, you know, because but he did leave office before the bubble burst, right? That was Hoover. We blame Hoover. We don't blame Coolidge. But with Clinton, it's easier to separate the man from what he did because the bubble really only burst once George W. Bush was in the White House. And there's one thing that we don't remember about the Clinton years. Clinton and Gingrich in 97 had a series of secret meetings in the White House where they decided on how to privatize Social Security. They came to an agreement. They agreed on a deal. Gingrich had the votes. Clinton would sign it. And they started on it. Clinton even went through with the first step, which was to announce it in his 1998 State of the Union address. And then the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke and the whole thing right. just got dropped immediately, you know, in the rush to impeach him.
How come you decided not to focus on these policies or these strategies being a reaction to whatever the GOP was doing?
I mean, of course, it is everything. And, you know, we have a two-party system. Everything done by one party is in reaction to or, you know, a dance with the other party. That's just the way the system works here. And one of the things that really struck me about the Democrats, it may even have been the idea that got me started on this project in the first place, was their extraordinary longing for consensus with the Republicans. You know, why do they do this? And this is unique to them. The Republicans don't long for consensus with the Democrats. I mean, they'll say they want a bipartisan, you know, solution. They say that all the time. But the way they act, they really don't care about that. But Democrats do. This is a passion for them that is not shared by other people or the other party.
One of the things that you point to as an example of catering to the professional class and to white-collar people and to academia is that President Obama, when elected, almost exclusively chose people with Ivy League degrees for his cabinet.
Yeah.
And you have a problem with that. But what's the alternative?
This is a fascinating question because I'm a great believer in expertise in government. Mm-hmm. I think government should be run by people that know what they're doing. That's one lesson we took away from the George W. Bush years is that you don't put hacks and cronies in charge of FEMA, right? And so I'm a great believer in government by experts. And here's Barack Obama comes in and brings in, I mean, the most concentrated set of academic credentials ever seen. What has changed over the years is that professionals don't think of themselves as servants of ordinary people anymore, or as a group that has our interests at heart, but rather as a group that acts in their own interest, and that's a very different thing. But so when I'm wondering about this question to get back to what you asked, and when did government by expert actually work? There has been a time when it worked. And that time was the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's administration, what they used to call the Brain Trust. We look back as one of the most successful administrations of all time. And so I started studying that and wondering if there was a really obvious difference between what Roosevelt did and what Obama did. But if you look at the people that they brought in to advise them, you start to notice differences very quickly. Roosevelt took people from all over the country, all over the social map, from all different walks of life, as long as they were good at what they did. His innermost circle of advisors were not unusually well-credentialed people. You look at, say, Harry Hopkins, who was his right-hand man during World War II. Hopkins was a social worker from Iowa. Or you look at his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, very famous. You know, he made him vice president eventually. Wallace went to Iowa State and came to government after editing a magazine for farmers.
So it seems like a keen eye for talent, irrespective of their degree.
Exactly. Right. And they're coming from places that aren't part of the establishment. And there's an important word here, which is orthodoxy. All of these people are really unorthodox. Roosevelt, of course, did have a contingent of Harvard guys. One of them was Galbraith, John Kenneth Galbraith, who helped to run the Office of Price Administration during the war. Galbraith spent his entire life fighting what he used to call conventional wisdom. Right? These are the kind of people that Roosevelt brought in. Obama's people are conventional wisdom.
Now, we're speaking about how the Democrats are catering more to the elite class and have sort of left working people in the dust. Do you see campaign finance and the constant need for fundraising as part and parcel to this?
Absolutely. That is part of the same story. And, you know, it's a fortunate coincidence for the Democrats that the group that they decided after the Vietnam War was more virtuous and that they wanted to identify with was an upper class group. You know, it's really lucky for them that things turned out that way. But at the, you know, it's funny that they made this decision before before money was played such a huge role in politics. But look, it's a for them, it's a very happy coincidence, and so they are today very comfortable and doing very well as a party of the upper 10%. And that really is who they are. You know, they are the, both they and the Republicans represent different factions of the nation's elite.
Do you see what you're talking about as attributable to the rise of Donald Trump?
Oh, my God. Yes. This is look, inequality is getting worse and worse. For a majority of people in America, you know, they do these polls all the time, and these people say that that the recession is still going on. Huge parts of this country are just falling apart. The social contract is basically over. You know, they're deindustrialized. This is what's happening to this country, and people are going to get angrier and angrier and angrier.
Do you see Bernie Sanders as does he stand for the traditional democratic values that you talk about in your book?
Ironically, he does. And I say ironically because he wasn't a Democrat up until very recently when he, you know, decided when he was going to run for president. But he does really represent this sort of New Deal tradition. It's kind of a rich irony when you think about it, that the guy who is most – who's closest to that kind of Franklin D. Roosevelt spirit is a guy who's barely even a Democrat. That's that tells you something right there.
Why do you think black people support the Democrats so overwhelmingly?
Oh, I think probably a big part of it is fear and hatred of the Republicans. I mean, there's a lot of people who are like that. That's a really common problem.
They're not Republicans, so it'll whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. They're not gonna vote for those guys. You know, of course not. You know, you remember the Clinton era expression? They've got nowhere else to go. And they would say this. Clinton used to he used to go out of his way to insult leaders of various Democratic constituencies. The most memorable being Jesse Jackson, right? But that was always the saying: they've got nowhere else to go. And he did the same thing to organized labor with NAFTA. But what's funny is all of these white working class voters, a large number of them who used to be Democrats, they have found somewhere else to go.
And that being?
Trump.
You wrote a column recently sort of saying that the media has gotten it wrong and they don't understand Trump's support base. Can you explain what the media is getting wrong about Trump's support base?
Well, it wasn't that they're wrong so much as that they were ignoring something that he was doing. Mm-hmm. I should preface this by saying I'm not a Trump fan. This man disgusts me and disturbs me in nearly every way. The way he ties his shoes to, you know, the things that he said. Everything about him bugs me. Okay, but that's the media was focusing on these kind of outrageous and bigoted and intolerant things that he says. You know, and I was watching this and thinking, well, that's not a good enough explanation for why you have this, you know, why people like him so much. Look, at least he has singled out and put his finger on the thing that drives a lot of working class people crazy, which is, you know, our government negotiates these deals like NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership that are obviously designed to harm them and to prosper other groups.
But how do they know that when they're 5,000 pages long? And then
you know how they know about what's in the trade deals? Because their bosses tell them.
Mm. But getting back to the Democratic Party, how can they return to traditional democratic values? And what, in your mind, does that look like?
I think it will happen. I think it's got to happen. You know, we're moving more and more to a crisis point all the time. We came to that crisis point in 2008. We came to the turning point. We just didn't turn. You know, because Obama did not take the opportunities that history afforded him to steer this country in a different direction. And by the way, which everyone thought he was going to do. And because of that, he's, as he likes to say, kicked the can down the road a piece, right? And it's going to this problem is not going to go away anytime soon.
That was Radio Times producer John Aaron's talk with author Thomas Frank about his book, Listen Liberal. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Elizabeth Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moskowain. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.